your right to be right. Our speaker, Jessica Pickett of Chicago, is a member of the Christian Science Board of Lectureship and is a graduate of the University of Chicago. For some years, she worked in the field of public relations, where the rights of men are indispensable for constructive human endeavor. She's had other practical experience in human affairs as a naval officer in the Women's Reserve during World War II. And since 1955, she has been in the full-time practice of Christian Science and has learned much of our God-given right to be right. She's here to talk with us about it. I'm honored to introduce her to you, Miss Pickett.
Thank you, James Lee, for that very gracious introduction. And it's such a real joy and delight to be here with you today and to share with you some of my experiences in this lecture work. Because actually, this lecture has grown out of this several years of experience I've had in this work. Shortly after I began lecturing, a young girl came up to me one night and asked, "How do you know when you are really right? How do you tell right from wrong?" I don't recall now just exactly what I said to her, but as she turned away, I had a feeling I hadn't done too good a job. And I've been looking for a better answer ever since, not only to clarify it for myself, but to share with others. There have been so many asking that same question. In my search, I thought of a very significant experience I had when I was a very small child. My mother and I had a secret society. We were its only members. We had a secret sign, too, the letter S. It stood for silence. And this meant that we each quietly held to what we felt was right. I was next to the last in a large family of six children, and our home was often a very lively place, as you can imagine. Our neighborhood was a lively one, too. Sometimes I was embroiled in situations I had no business in. Sometimes I got pretty confused about what's right and what's wrong. Then my mother would catch my eye, lay her finger on her lips, and remind me, "Remember S." Our mutual secret always brought me right back where I belonged. As I think back on this close relationship between my mother and me, I realized that it was here I first learned something about a wonderful asset we all have. A Peace Corps, I call it. C-O-R-E. A deep inner core of unshakable peace. A place of strength in the most trying and difficult circumstances. A mental refuge where right ideas can appear. You might say this lecture this morning is an invitation to you to join our secret society, to accept the secret sign, Remember S. And what's more important, to find within this center of strength and peace the difference between right and wrong. Many of you already belong to it. I'm meeting new members everywhere I go. I had an encounter such as this not long ago in a big hotel down in Florida with a bellhop, a fine-looking young man. He carried my bags down, and we were waiting for someone to pick me up. I asked him if he had been in Vietnam. He said he had been, so I asked about the drug situation there. Was it really as bad as we were hearing? Oh, yes, he replied. It's even worse. That I can understand in a way why this is so, he said. When that order comes to move out into the jungle, it's a pretty frightening thing to face. Then someone may say, well, come on, let's just take a shot and get on with it. But you know, I just never could go along with that, he said. The thought always came to me, if this is the time for me to meet my Maker, I want him to see me like I really am. What a thought. See me like I really am. You must have had a wonderful upbringing to have a thought like that, I said. No, he told me, I grew up in the worst part of this city. There was nothing but knifing and stealing and mugging. Nothing but crime and drunkenness and drugs. But that just wasn't for me, he said. The more I saw as a kid, the less I wanted to be like what I saw. Yeah, I like to have a good time just like everybody else. But not with alcohol and drugs. If I'm going to have a good time, I want to know it's me that's having it. How logical and convincing this young man was. I marveled at his insight, his integrity, and his moral courage. He had a built-in sense of right, and he knew how to protect it. It was easy to see that in his own way he had found his Peace Corps. What was this young man's secret? His sense of being right. To be like I really am, as he put it. Just what does it mean to have a built-in sense of right? In short, to be right. Certainly it doesn't mean it's your prerogative to be on the top of the heap over everybody else. It doesn't mean you've got the wit to outwit everyone who stands in your way. It doesn't mean you've got everything going your way. As far as I'm concerned, it means you've got to be right with yourself. As sure as you're alive, you already embody this sense of right. It's the truth about you. It's what you really are. Anything contrary to this is the untruth about you. It's what you really aren't. Ask anyone how he knows right from wrong. Almost invariably he'll say, you just know it. It's a matter of conscience. But many of us don't listen to conscience. Just look how some warp of conscience is saying to them. It's really a matter of integrity, isn't it? Conscience in itself isn't enough. You've got to listen to it. I like this definition of integrity given in Webster's. An unimpaired or unmarred condition. Entire correspondence with an original condition. Now, from that basis, you can begin to deduce what you really are. Your original condition is you as you exist in the eyes of your Maker. It's seeing yourself just as He made you, a total being, an integer. Unadulterated by the world's misconceptions about man, about you. It's pure you. No, conscience in itself isn't enough. Neither is a human sense of integrity. What we really need is conscience plus integrity, plus something else. Plus what? Just the truth about you. The spiritual truth of what you really are. Conscience and integrity, impelled by the truth of what you really are, spiritual, correlates you with your Maker, that divine first cause and creator, the principle of all beings. In Christian Science, we understand and acknowledge this principle to be spirit, just as Jesus pointed out. God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. These words of Jesus are found in the Gospel of John, in the Bible. And Mary Baker Eddy, the discoverer and founder of Christian Science, says in Science and Health, the Key to the Scriptures, spiritual causation is the one question to be considered. For more than all others, spiritual causation relates to human progress. These two books are the Christian Science textbooks. Your true integrity, then, is understanding yourself spiritually. It separates what you are from what you are not. And it gives you the authority to make decisions on the side of God of what is holy good. When this divine truth speaks to you through the voice of your conscience, then you can be sure you're right. You know it. How? By the inner peace you feel. You're standing then on your spiritual integrity, what you really are. I think of spiritual integrity as what the tent pole is to the tent, figuratively speaking, a deep set, central, stabilizing voice that remains firm and fixed and withstands the storm. The tent depends upon the fixity of that pole. The tent may be buffeted, sometimes ripped and torn, but that center pole stands. Spiritual integrity is like that. It stands. Because it's spiritual, it's unrelated to material conditions. Yet when exercised, it's master of them. Or you might say this integrity is your spiritual backbone. It keeps you intact. It holds you upright. It gives you the conviction of right as right and wrong as wrong. And it gives you the strength to be right and the courage to stand against whatever appears to be wrong with the same conviction Jesus expressed. It was Jesus who gave us the basis for right judgment, how to know when you're really right. Christian Science accepts Jesus' way as the basis for choosing between right and wrong. Jesus had to make decisions just as we do. In his last hours, he made his most provocative decision, a decision that sets the basis for all right decisions. Jesus' decisions were made in his conscious spiritual conviction of being at one with God and right with God. In this spiritual altitude of thought, his divine consciousness of being and his conscience met and found peace with God. As I said, Jesus' decisions set the basis for all right decisions. We see him in Gethsemane, just before his crucifixion, struggling for his very life, praying that he might be freed from the dark cloud enshrouding him. On his knees, he pled to be spared the agony of that hour. But he more earnestly prayed, "Not my will, but thine be done." Jesus' decisions were made in his conscious spiritual conviction of being at one with God and right with God. "I and my Father are one," he said. In this spiritual altitude of thought, his divine consciousness of being and his conscience met and found peace with God. Jesus' decisions had one purpose only, spiritual advancement. Jesus then gave us the yardstick for right decisions. Spiritual advancement. Will the decision I'm making advance me spiritually? This question points up a rule in Christian science. When we adhere to it, we bless all mankind as well as ourselves. Experts are calling today a time of over-choice. We are faced with so many pros and cons in every human question, every decision. What a relief the simplicity of Jesus' rule can prove to be. Yes, what a relief the spiritual simplicity is in the midst and face of material complexity. No multiple choice here. Your choice on the side of God, good, is wholly spiritual and wholly good. It's the ultimate choice. When you've made your decision according to your highest spiritual understanding, when your conscience coincides with your consciousness of being, what you really are spiritually, you can rest your case there. Furthermore, you can trust the outcome. If your decision is advancing you spiritually, why, it's naturally advancing your human perceptive will. It's strengthening you morally and physically. And it's bringing you a step nearer to seeing yourself as you really are. It's bringing you peace instead of a restless and uncertain groping for the you you'd like to be. When your decisions are made in this spiritual sense of being, you know you are right. You are expressing your true selfhood, your unmarred divine originality. I'd like to illustrate this with an experience of a young friend of mine. We'll call him Bob. For a time, Bob had seemed all mixed up about himself, who he really was and who others really were. It was his relationship with girls that worried him most. Why didn't they like him? Why did the girls he fancied always make him feel so immature and unworthy? Why did his first date with them always turn out to be his last? "Perhaps you're looking at the wrong girl," I said to him once when he talked with me about it. "Why don't you try a new tack? Instead of thinking of her as a merely humanly or physically attractive creature and treating her like that, why don't you try getting acquainted with who she really is? I mean, look for the spiritual quality she expresses. Now, this standard of measurement for personal relationships isn't limited to Bob and his peers. It stands up under any circumstances. It's the rule for all personal relationships that are going to be harmonious and satisfying. But I want to tell you about Bob particularly. After his next date, he was beaming. You know, he said, "We had a wonderful time. I found so many of those qualities you mentioned, I can't count them. I liked her. I told her so. She was really beautiful. Beautiful from within. And she was sincere and considerate, too. And she was fun. We laughed a lot. She liked it when I told her these things. That made me feel good, too. I felt at ease with her." Dates like these became a common occurrence in Bob's life, and the interesting thing about it is that he himself completely changed. He began to express more of the qualities of his true selfhood. He became more humble and confident, more mature and poised. I think you'd say his spiritual integrity was coming through loud and clear. About a year later, one of the loveliest young creatures you can imagine came onto the scene. The very expression of grace. The kind of girl Bob had always really loved, not merely craved. And now he was ready for her. She found in him the quality she needed. And I think you'd call it real love. They've been married for a number of years and have a young son. They're very happy. Bob had suddenly caught a glimpse of who he really was. It became clearer to him as he searched for it and found it in others. The Christ view, the view of man Jesus always accepted, is the true view of each one of us. Because the Christ is the true idea of God and of man's sonship with God. To see yourself as Jesus saw himself, and to feel the impetus of the Christ directing your steps, that's the way into the kingdom of heaven. That peace corps I spoke of earlier. It's to be born again spiritually. It's discovering the you that existed from the beginning of time. It's to be reborn and renamed with a new spiritual name as a son or a spiritual idea of God. It's you in your original condition. Pure you. But is there really any other you? Is there a right you and a wrong you? Just what does it mean to be wrong? Doesn't it mean actually that you've accepted the wrong view of the true you and are acting on this basis of duality? This mistaken view of yourself, we learn in the Christian Science, is a mirage of the physical senses. It's a suppositional view in which everything is turned upside down. The scriptures call it a fallen state of man. Have you ever looked through a magnifying glass? I mean, held it up to your eye and looked clear through it across the room. Everything in the room is upside down. You're looking through and beyond the focal distance of the glass. Now, that's what the physical senses do to the true concept of yourself. They take you outside the focal distance of divine consciousness, uprightness. They give you an inverted, an untrue view of yourself. Mrs. Eddy calls the mortal and materialistic evils a conspiracy against man. And the man who acts in accordance with their false evidence, she says, he is joining in a conspiracy against himself, against his own awakening to the awful unreality by which he has been deceived. She calls this state of deception a form of intoxication, more difficult to break than that of alcohol or drugs. When you act in accordance with this false evidence, like the drunk man, you lose sight of who you really are. You act as if you were an entirely different person. You are bound to be wrong. A man was facing trial for larceny, and he was explaining to a reporter how he committed his criminal act. You stop feeling human, he said. You can't afford to have feelings, or you won't make money. In this mentally intoxicated or distorted view of yourself, you are apt to disregard the rights of others. It's an attitude entirely unrelated to spirit, God. It's the egocentric view of man. It's self-created instead of God-created. And therefore, its effects are self-centered and completely selfish. A young woman had overcome the dope habit, so she had fallen to the very lowest depth, where she knew the gutters better than any cockroach, as she put it. She said, on dope, you care only for yourself. You are utterly, utterly selfish. One only has to listen to a personal testimony like this to feel the emptiness and loneliness and isolation of living outside the focal distance of divine authority, of acting under the misdirection of the false view of yourself with its selfish disregard of the others. It was my own awakening from my selfish disregard of others that healed me of smoking years ago. I'd been trying for some time to break this habit which I'd picked up in college, but to no avail. Now I had begun the study of Christian Science, and I used to spend my lunch time each day in a Christian Science reading room studying. I often saw there someone very dear to me, a relative. And I'd stop and say hello as I went out. One day, he followed me out. You know, he said, I almost wish you wouldn't stop to talk to me in the reading room. The smell of tobacco seems so out of place on you there. Now, I know he wanted to see me free from this habit just as much as I did. His approach may not sound very kind to you, and I don't recommend it, generally. But in this case, prompted as it was by a deep, loving concern, it worked. I never felt so hurt, but not by his approach only. The fact that I had been offensive in a place I really loved, and to those for whom I had such respect, came as a great blow. As I walked back to my office, I think I never felt so low. But you know, I was human. That was the end of the smoking. Someone who cared had seen me like I really was, and his true view of me was a rebuke to the false view of myself I was holding on so tightly. tightly to release me from that conspiracy Mrs. Eddy speaks of, and brought me right back into focus with my true selfhood. It set me upright again. Every fault you overcome does that. It sets you upright again, and it gives you a sense, a new sense of inner peace, such as you have never felt before. That's what we do with this false view. My answer is, bury it. Bury it. I'd like to tell you another experience of my own that bears out this very point. I call this story, The Tomb of the Unknown Sinner. One day a letter came in my mail that was signed anonymous. There was no indication whether it was from a man or a woman. The writer said he had been a Christian Scientist most of his life and had had many healings. But there was a moral problem he hadn't licked. He just couldn't face a Christian Science practitioner with it. And so he was writing anonymous and it was help. And explained that he wasn't sure I'd care to take an anonymous case, so he wasn't enclosing payment. That he would know by the effect whether or not he was having help, and he would take care of the payment later. Most anonymous letters go in my wastebasket, and this one did too. But it just wouldn't stay there. No matter what I was doing, whether I was getting the dinner, doing the dishes, going to and from the office, anonymous was always with me. Then these thoughts came to me. Why, there's no anonymity in true consciousness in mind or God. Every one of God's creatures is known to him. His name is written in heaven, to borrow a Bible phrase. He is the creation of God. He's upright and godlike. He's the beloved of God. The only anonymity then must be the anonymity of the sin and the sinner. You may say I was praying when I thought like this. Praying scientifically, just as Jesus did when he healed people. Then, out of the blue, all kinds of immoralities began to pop up all around me. Even in the apartment right next door to me, where a young girl lived alone. You know, I became quite indignant when I saw this problem flaunting itself on my very threshold. Then I caught myself up. How do I know that this girl isn't my anonymous? She may be the very one who has asked me to help her. How could I condemn someone I was trying to heal? You know, a Christian Science practitioner has to accept the true you as the only you and hold to it. That's what he is. The tomb of the unknown soldier flashed across my mind. What I need, I concluded, is the tomb of the unknown sinner. There I'll bury all those false evidences of man. I'll give them their total anonymity, a complete blackout. I'll give back to every man I know his birthright of spiritual integrity, his true name, as it's written in heaven. Some of you here are familiar with Mrs. Eddy's definition of burial in science and health. Corporeality and physical sense put out of sight and hearing, annihilation, submergence in spirit, immortality brought to light. That definition really grips me. I began at once to bury every false evidence of a mortal sinner. I became submerged in the realization of man as he really is, the image and likeness of God, the Christ idea of God. Pretty soon I had a letter from Anonymous saying the work was being effected. He imposed a payment. I continued the scientific praying, and pretty soon there were other evidences of healing. My next-door neighbor told me happily one day that she was going to be married, and she soon moved away with her husband. A young man who had been on trial for a major crime was released on parole. And this new opportunity gave him a new opportunity to see himself as he really was. It set him up right again, and it started him going forward in a purposeful, harmonious, and useful way that he is continuing to advance in. A young man who had been suffering from the painful physical effects of a sense of guilt was entirely healed. His new view of himself gave him new opportunities and new capabilities he had never dreamed of. They resulted in a wonderful new job such as he had never had before, in line with his natural talent. He surrendered a sense of guilt, of wrong, for the Christly conscience that's always right. Because this conscience is related to spiritual causation, it's motivated by divine power. Therefore, it always leads in the line of human progress as well as spiritual advancement. My tomb of the unknown sinner has become a very effective way of dealing with every case of anonymity, of false selfhood, and of putting an end to the conspiracy of the material senses against man's integrity. The poet Robert Frost has challenged mankind to what he calls a one-man revolution. Many years before this, Mrs. Eddy wrote, "Science is absolute and final. It is revolutionary in its very nature, for it upsets all that is not upright. It annuls false evidence and says to the five material senses, 'Having eyes, ye see not, and ears, ye hear not, neither can you understand.'" Another statement of hers brings out the other side of this coin. It deals with a sense of conscience motivated by spiritual integrity. It says, "Metaphysical or divine science reveals the principle and method of perfection, how to attain a mind in harmony with God, in sympathy with all that is right, and opposed to all that is wrong, and a body governed by this mind." We can oppose all that is wrong without opposing anyone, ourselves or others. Mrs. Eddy dealt in a Christianly scientific way with every wrong that confronted her. She herself went through all kinds of trials and sufferings during the years she was founding the Christian Science Movement. Indignity after indignity was leveled against her, and innumerable false accusations against her integrity. But these only enabled her later on to point out to the world the anonymity of sin and how to resolve scientifically the questions of right and wrong in an impersonal way. her acceptance and understanding of the principle of innocence, man's true guiltless state of being, enabled her to set forth the rules of this principle in the Christian Science textbook. It enabled her to found a religion dedicated to restoring men physically and morally by revealing their unblemished spiritual state of being, man's pure and perfect selfhood, created and maintained by Spirit, God. Her revelation of this Christ selfhood brings harmony to every kind of discord. Mrs. Eddy healed the sick. She reversed the evidences of death. But I think she must have particularly loved the opportunity of lifting the weight of guilt and shame from those struggling with a false view of themselves. She encouraged so many people who came to her with questions of right and wrong to see themselves spiritually as they really were, and to act in accordance with this high view. I recall one young man who asked Mrs. Eddy how to deal with a sense of wrong. She directed him to a statement of hers in Science and Health. The devotion of thought to an honest achievement makes the achievement possible. Exceptions only concern this rule, proving that failure is occasioned by a too feeble faith. Mrs. Eddy never lost interest in the young man's problem until she saw his faith and his integrity restored. And she certainly gives us authority in that statement to know that our very smallest desire for spiritual good is a link to the principle of infinite divine good. So you can be sure, if you are doing your best today, as far as you spiritually understand it, it will be better tomorrow. And your God-directed choice of what's spiritually right will reveal the practical footsteps necessary to your advancement, and will give you the strength and courage to take these footsteps. How can you be sure you are right? Is there a sign? Yes, indeed there is. As in any battle, the reward of victory is peace. But who can describe the peace that comes from being spiritually right, from a victory over a wrong decision? It's really beyond description. It's the peace of God that passes all understanding, as St. Paul puts it. Your spiritual integrity always wins this prize, because true integrity goes hand in hand with peace. It's the peace core I spoke of earlier, the very nucleus of your being, the heart and soul and essence of true selfhood. This is the kind of peace the whole world's trying to find. It's the peace of the Christ that Jesus lived and taught and established. This peace was Jesus' legacy or bequest to his followers, as he indicated when he said, "Peace I leave with you. My peace I give unto you." Basic inner peace. Unshakable and indestructible peace. It's not contingent on material conditions, nor on the material senses for authority. It's not contingent on trial and error. You can't buy it. You can't negotiate for it. And certainly you don't find it by going on a trip with alcohol or drugs or any other material stimulant just as the young bellhop intuitively knew. The world has tantalized us with a hope of peace, always just beyond reach, to be sought for, or protested for, or bargained for. But wars, protests, even armistices haven't given us peace. The world can't give us peace, no, because peace isn't of the world. But when peace is seen as spiritual, as stemming from that divine principle, God, the source of man's integrity or true selfhood, this spiritual realization can affect peace among men. This peace is tangible, that is, it's manifested in a practical way. It has its outward as well as its inward signs. Earlier, I spoke of my mother's ability to restore peace in discordant conditions. This had its physical, its healing effects as well. So often when something went wrong in our neighborhood, an accident, an illness, a sorrow, a call for help, the cry would be, "Get Mrs. Pickett." Her peace always assured prompt help. 1/4 of July, amidst the flash and bang of fireworks up and down our street, there came a sudden lull. Then an urgent call for help. This time, it was my father who was in need. A giant firecracker had exploded in his hand, mangling it. My father wasn't a Christian Scientist at this time, and a doctor came. He felt the hand must be amputated at once. But my mother stood firm against such a permanently disabling operation. Her strength and courage were felt. The kind doctor was moved by her serenity and her confidence that healing would come without surgery. A reprieve was given. He said he'd come back later. He did what he could and left. Day after day elapsed. My mother's faith in God's healing power never lapsed. She knew she was right in this. No amputation took place. It was only a matter of time until the outward signs of my mother's sense of rightness and inner peace, her perception of man's pure spiritual nature, were manifested. Without any material applications, the flesh was restored to my father's hand, and my father had full use of that hand ever after that. The peace of the Christ restores harmony to every kind of discord. Jesus fully exemplified this. Isn't this why Jesus is becoming a popular and loved name again today? Some are turning to Jesus again as the authority for peace and are willing to reconsider his promise as the way of achieving it. They're turning again to Jesus' message for answers to troubling questions. Questions such as, how do you know when you are really right? How do you tell right from wrong? They are looking for answers that will bring peace, real peace, to our entire experience. No one ever expressed more of this peace within than Jesus did, and the practical nature of it. He didn't say, bring the whole world into a peaceful settlement, then you'll have peace. He was concerned with each one finding peace within himself and expressing it in the world, now. He knew that individual peace was the foundation for world peace. To exemplify and demonstrate this inner peace was Jesus' message, mission, his mission. We might say with more than a mere play on words that his peace core, the peace within him, was the nucleus for the peace core he established with his followers. Peace core in this latter instance spelled C-O-R-P-S. We could say that it was actually Jesus who gave us the original idea of a peace corps. He called his peace corps the peacemakers. And he referred to them as the children of God. Peacemakers along with him. The word peace was Jesus' form of greeting. The peace he gave the world was far more than a mere salutation, however. It indicated the very presence and power of God, the Christ, King, that Jesus represented. It was a force for good, and it was felt wherever Jesus went. This Christ peace is the fulfillment of God's pact or promise of everlasting peace with his creation. It was this peace pact, this divine pact, that Jesus demonstrated. The words peace and pact come from the same root, meaning an agreement, a covenant. This peace pact, then, means, first, binding peace in and with God, the principle of peace, through Christ, the Prince of Peace. This brings peace within ourselves. Then, peace without, peace with others. It places you in the true peace corps, along with the peacemakers or children of God. It's the supreme force for right, operating in the world at all times, individually and collectively. It begins with your smallest right decision, and it grows and spreads. When we're in doubt, then, about what's right and what's wrong, wouldn't we be safe in holding up pending decisions alongside a spiritual yardstick? The yardstick for spiritual advancement. We might ask ourselves these questions. One, does the decision I'm making put me right with myself? Does it bring me peace within myself? Two, does it put me right with others? Does it put me into harmony with those who are seeking this true peace? Three, does it put me right with God? Is it demonstrating the divine principle of peace that unites all in one true peace corps, one true brotherhood? This search for the right way is a continuing evolution and revolution going on within each one of us. You may already have found a satisfying answer to questions of right and wrong, but don't stop searching. Spiritual advancement is always expanding and uniting us. You're bound to find others with good answers, too. Intercommunication adds right to right. Your strength will strengthen others. Theirs will strengthen you. And besides, you'll have found another brother. And who knows how far this brotherhood, this true peace corps, will expand through your very desire to stretch it. It will go on and on and on until someday, perhaps sooner than we realize, we shall all catch a glimpse of the promise or pact of universal brotherhood and everlasting peace. Good morning.
Remember next Monday at 2:30 p.m. for the next Cape Christian Science Lecture over KBRG.